From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as rescue efforts continue in Oklahoma City, we talk with a member of an urban search and rescue unit that has been dispatched to help search for and rescue people trapped in the federal building. Also today, the secret meaning of the boxes, bottles, cans, and tubes you have in your kitchen and bathroom cupboards. We talk with Thomas Hine, author of The Total Package, A History of Consumer Packaging. And we speak with Colonel Fred Peck, who testified against gays in the military. And we meet his son, Scott, who is gay. Scott has written a new memoir called All American Boy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A car bomb ripped off the front of a federal building in downtown Oklahoma City today. At least 8 people are confirmed dead, 6 of them children. The death toll, especially that of children, is expected to rise. At least 200 people have been hurt. The building housed a daycare center and several federal offices, including an office of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. There are some Secret Service agents who are missing and unaccounted for. The FBI is looking for 3 suspects, 3 men, 2 of whom are described as Middle Eastern. They're said to be driving a brown Chevrolet pickup with tinted windows. No one's claimed responsibility for the blast. This is the 2nd anniversary of the fiery end of the Waco standoff, but members of the Branch Davidians, the target of the Waco standoff, say they are not involved. One news report from Oklahoma City also said a member of the Nation of Islam claimed responsibility, but that group also vehemently denies any connection with the attack. Law enforcement officials have stepped up security at federal buildings around the country. Police say at least 2 bomb threats have been received at FBI headquarters in Washington. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Tourists were evacuated from the Federal Bureau of Investigation after an anonymous caller phoned in a bomb threat, police said. Apparently, no bomb was found at the site. Elsewhere in the Capitol, police began restricting access to parking garages and stepping up routine searches at entrances to buildings. Federal buildings in Boston, Omaha, Portland, Detroit, and Wilmington, Delaware were also evacuated in the wake of the Oklahoma explosion. In Boston, employees at the Internal Revenue Service reported finding office doors unlocked. In Delaware, a caller reportedly phoned a local newspaper. No explosives were discovered at any of the sites. I'm John Nielsen. In Washington,
President Clinton says he will not hesitate to use all the powers of the presidency, including a veto, if Republicans follow through on a threat to put legislation he opposes onto the debt ceiling bill. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The debt ceiling bill is known as a must-pass piece of legislation. It extends the government's ability to borrow money. Without an extension of the debt ceiling, the government would shut down. Speaker Newt Gingrich has said that he may attach legislation the president opposes to the debt ceiling bill, in effect daring the president to shut down the government with a veto. Today, Mr. Clinton said that kind of strategy would be a mistake. No president of the United States, he said, could ever be blackmailed that way.
A strategy to sort of put me in a box would be an error because I will still exercise the power of the presidency in the interest of the American people.
The president's press secretary, Mike McCurry, was even more emphatic. He said the president would not cower from vetoing anything that was not in the interest of the American people. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 28 points to 4,207. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq has fallen 9 points to 816. This is NPR. Indiana Senator Richard Lugar has formally declared his candidacy for the Republican presidential nomination. He says he'll scrap the federal income tax, offer an alternative to President Clinton's foreign policy, and reinvigorate America's moral character. He made his announcement in downtown Indianapolis, where he served as mayor before being elected to 4 Senate terms. Lugar says the odds are long against his better-known and better-financed Republican rivals. He is the 8th Republican and 4th Senator to formally declare his candidacy. Iran says it is determined to go ahead with plans to acquire nuclear energy technology, despite U.S. attempts to block the purchase. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Speaking at the end of a 3-day visit to India, Iranian President Hashemi Rafsanjani said his country is determined to build a nuclear power reactor for peaceful purposes. Iran is trying to buy the technology from China and Russia, but President Clinton has said he would aggressively try to block any transfer of nuclear technology to Iran. The U.S. is concerned that Iran intends to build nuclear weapons, something Tehran denies. Speaking out against what he called American injustice and discrimination, Rafsanjani said he expects Russia to resist U.S. pressure and go ahead with plans to sell 4 nuclear reactors to Iran. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
Again, our top story today. Federal officials say a car bomb blew off the front of a federal building in Oklahoma City today. The death toll has risen now to 19, most children. The bombed building contained a daycare center, as well as offices for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Secret Service agents who were in the building have not been accounted for. The president has directed Attorney General Janet Reno to lead the investigation. She has dispatched an FBI team to the scene, as well as a team from ATF. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Emergency rescue workers are now trying to locate and rescue people who are still trapped in the rubble of the federal office building in Oklahoma City. A car bomb blew it up this morning. Earlier today, I spoke with Frank Salomon, a public information officer with the Urban Search and Rescue Unit, a special rescue team based in Phoenix, Arizona, which was activated by the Federal Emergency Management Agency to assist in the rescue effort. The team includes specially trained doctors, heavy equipment operators for safely removing rubble, and technicians with special devices to listen for the sounds of people who are trapped. I asked Frank Salomon to describe what happens when the team arrives on the scene.
When the team arrives to wherever the incident may be, it breaks off into different groups. And each group will have a structure engineer, they will have a doctor, they will have a hazardous material technician, they will have a technical rescue member, and they will have either a dog or fiber optics or any other type of device to locate the patient or the person trapped.
The rescue team has to find the people who are trapped.
Exactly.
In the office building, how do you find where the people are? Do you have any special high-tech equipment that can help you locate
yes,
them?
Yes, we have, of course, the most important one is just screaming out, mm-hmm. calling for people and trying to listen. We have some high-tech listening equipment that is very sensitive to noise that we can apply into the rubble, and we can try to hear people breathing. We can try to hear people crying for help. We also have fiber optic equipment where we can tunnel through the debris and have a camera at the very tip of it so that we could see where this where the people are trapped. We have infrared equipment that detects the heat of the patient, of the person trapped in an atmosphere where it's pretty cold there. It's going to be great to be able to detect a warm body or any type of heat coming from this person that is trapped, and that will locate the patient or the person that is trapped. We have dogs that have great sniffing ability to find people that are trapped, and of course there's other means of the try to find area maps of that building where meetings were being held to try to detect a general area where we can start from.
What are some of the typical dangers of rescuing people who are trapped in rubble in a nine-story building?
We have secondary collapse. That's perhaps is one of the most important or the most dangerous for any rescuer, is going into an area that is very unstable.
Are there different phases of rescue you expect this operation will go to?
Yes, most definitely. The first phase, of course, is to try to detect and remove all the patients that are easily removed, as far as by walking them off or by applying them on a backboard and removing them without having to go through any deep digging. The second phase of it would be to shore up the area as far as stabilize the area and to rescue any people that can be rescued by just simple means of removing some minor debris. And then, of course, the final phase of it would be removing the major debris, which is the large structural items, the large floors, concrete, beams, and columns, removing them. And at that time, we're looking at a few days into the event. By the time we get to that phase, and by then it no longer becomes a search and rescue, but it becomes a body retrieval incident.
What kind of training do the people on the team go to prepare for a rescue like this?
Okay, there's different members of this team. For instance, let's say the hazardous material incidents team, which is a component of the whole FEMA team, they go through many, many hours of classroom education as far as different chemicals and different environments where these patients may be. We're looking at a possible gas rupture. Natural gas lines that may be ruptured, and natural gas is collecting in low-lying pockets of this collapse area. Any type of ignition source would cause a large, another explosion secondary to the explosion that happened earlier. So we need our hazardous material team in there with devices, with instruments to detect the atmosphere, to do an atmospheric reading. Many of these areas where the people might be trapped could be oxygen-depleted, meaning that they're in such a confined area that no more oxygen, all the oxygen is used up, and that also creates a very dangerous atmosphere for firefighters or rescuers. The people from the other component of that is the technical rescue. They have countless of hours in training in mountain rescue, in confined space rescue, tunneling type of incidents, and out here in the Southwest, we have a big problem with swift water rescue and flash floods and stuff. They've been trained in many different types of styles and situations.
How's your team getting out there? Are they flying or driving?
Yeah, what we have here is all the members are here at the academy right now. They've been briefed on the situation. They've got all the equipment loaded into two large semis. Those two large semis are on their way out to Luke Air Force Base, which is a military establishment here in Phoenix. They're going to be loaded into a C-141 air cargo aircraft, and that cargo aircraft will be flying into Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. All our members will be in that C-141 along with all the equipment. We have earlier I stated that we'd sent an initial four-member crew to assess the situation. Those members are flying out by Southwest Airlines on a commercial aircraft to right to Oklahoma City to determine how much more equipment and personnel will be needed.
Well, I wish the people on your team good luck, and thank you very much for your time and telling us a little bit about the operation.
Okay.
Frank Salomon is a public information officer with the Phoenix Urban Search and Rescue Unit, which is assisting in the rescue operation at the Oklahoma City Federal Building. When you go through the supermarket with your grocery cart, every tube of toothpaste, every cereal box, can of soup, jar of jam, bottle of ketchup, and box of cookies is trying to say to you, "Buy me." It's part of the package's job to sell you on the product inside. Thomas Hine has written a new book on the design of packages. It's called The Total Package, The Evolution and Secret Meanings of Boxes, Bottles, Cans, and Tubes. Tom Hine is the author of the previous book, Populux, and he writes a syndicated column on architecture and design for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I have, in honor of your presence today, I have brought with me a bunch of cans and bottles and jars and tubes from my cabinets to talk to you about the packaging. Let's start with this. This is a can of Campbell's tomato soup. I actually bought this a while ago. I don't like tomato soup very much, and I don't know why I bought it, but this is probably about 2 years old. What's important about this can?
Well, of course, this can has been changed since you bought it. But the can in its essentials dates back to about 1900. And prior to that, Campbell's was a local canner in the southern New Jersey area that canned a lot of different things and put pictures of those vegetables on the cans. And so they went from these rather evocative cans to a very standardized can. They picked the colors. Actually, one of the executives went to a football game between Penn and Cornell, and he really liked the red and white uniforms that the Cornell players were wearing. And in the center, they put a gold seal that they had won at one of the many international exhibitions for the product. What's important about this soup, or about this can then, is that it really established not a product, but a brand. Now, the reason it's been changed in the last couple of years is that a lot of people are like you. They bought the soup because it's been sold as warmth and security, more than it's been sold in a way as food. And so Campbell's did some surveys, and they found that almost everybody has a few cans of Campbell's soup in their cabinet, but they don't eat it very much, or they don't eat it often enough to keep the sales going. And so what they've done is put some pictures of warm soup on the label so that when you look in your cabinet, more than when you look on the store, you'll think, hey, I can eat this. I just don't have to have this in case of total disaster, but this is something that I can eat.
All right. How about this bottle of Heinz tomato ketchup?
Yeah, well, this is you're an old-fashioned sort of person in that you have the classic glass bottle with the narrow opening that it takes so long to get the ketchup through. Only in the last couple of years have American tastes shifted toward the larger plastic squeeze bottle that it's easier to get the ketchup out. That there's, with packages, there tends in some cases to be a struggle between the sort of iconic package, and this is particularly true of people, for example, who don't eat much tomato soup or much ketchup, that they tend to prefer the iconic package, whereas people who use ketchup in vast quantities are probably going to go for the squeeze bottle.
I keep the ketchup for that rare guest who actually uses it. This is actually maybe an antique. So this is a classic bottle. It, from your book, I get the impression that younger people use the squeeze bottle and older people prefer the more iconic glass bottle.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Okay, let's see. I have two bottles of mouthwash here, both of which you write about in your book. One is Listerine and the other is Scope. What can we learn about packaging by looking at these two bottles and comparing them?
Well, Listerine, of course, this is an interesting case because it's a small plastic version of... Actually, it isn't. It's glass. Sorry. This is a small version of an iconic glass bottle whose logo is done in a typeface that's so styleless that you just know it's good for you. It's the kind of typeface that you'd use for a poison or some such thing. It says Listerine antiseptic in very, very strong strong letters. And what you're doing with this package, it is in a way punishing yourself. That somehow or other, original sin is involved here. And for if you believe in that, then you're likely to go with Listerine.
I always thought of it as being medicinal, that they wanted to give you the sense that this might not taste good, but it's good for you, it's medicinal, it will kill those germs and make you a better person.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I was being perhaps a bit over the top on that. But
let's look at the Scope bottle.
You know, Scope came out in the 1960s and was a very popular introduction, and it doesn't say antiseptic. It has a soft form. It has a kind of a characterless bottle, really, and it's green, which, in the kind of simple-minded way that package designers, but perhaps consumers, think green is like a green light. There's a certain amount of, it's okay, you know, that bad breath is part of life. You know, you do it, and then you go out and do whatever you have to do. It's not a punishment. It's permissive.
You trace the first packaging to drugs and cosmetics. What kind of items?
Well, with drugs, of course, what we take drugs on faith, essentially. And very early on, the makers of patent medicines realized that the shape of their bottle and the distinctiveness of their bottle and the degree of belief that they could create in their bottle was much more important than whatever was inside. Cosmetics, and you could say that the packaging of cosmetics goes all the way back to the ancient Egyptians, that cosmetics are about magic. And one thing that we haven't really talked about with packaging is magic, that there is this quality of that psychologists have found again and again to be true, that the package rubs off on the product and rubs off on the user, that there is an aura. And so if you have a substance that's most supposed to make you look more beautiful or smell more beautiful, you want to have it in a beautiful container. Especially things that are in small containers are more powerful than big containers.
Why is that?
Well, because they're likely to contain something that's precious, that a perfume or some kind of cosmetic is an expensive thing, and so the package that you have it in is more important.
My guest is Thomas Hein, author of the new book, The Total Package. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Hein is my guest, and he writes about architecture and urban design for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His new book is called The Total Package, and it's a history of packaging of consumer items. You reprint this fantastic ad from Unita Biscuits. And this is from, around the turn of the century when they first started packaging biscuits. I'm going to ask you to read this ad. Tell us something about it and then read it for us.
They really didn't sell the idea that their crackers or cookies were any better than anybody else's, but that because they were packaged, they were cleaner and purer. And so this ad ran in a lot of publications in 1901, and the headline, no pictures actually, the headline on it was, "The Grocer Couldn't Help It." And it goes on, "When the grocery boy swept out the store, he couldn't find the lid of the cracker box, so he covered them over with a codfish crate. After he weighed a mackerel and drew a quart of kerosene, he filled an order for a pound of crackers, which was carefully picked from the cracker box under the codfish crate. The customer who bought the crackers said they tasted queer, but the grocer couldn't help it."
That's a wonderful ad. I wonder if shopping was like that your crackers would taste of codfish and whatever else was placed on top of the bin that it was in.
Well, the ad industry at that time was dominated by writers. And they certainly went out of their way to find as many really distasteful things that could be messing up your crackers as possible.
But that was the big thing, I guess, about early packaging, is that it protected the food, and they were selling the protection of packaging in the advertising.
Sure. And, of course, it still does protect the food, and it still does preserve the food. The early packaging, you know, another important case of early packaging was Borden's original condensed milk, which was introduced at a time when there were scandals in New York City about cows being fed the byproducts of the makings of whiskey, and that the milk was adulterated. And when you have a package, you not only protect the milk from dirt, but you also have a kind of investment that you as a seller are identified with the package. You have made an investment in advertising and in machinery and in a delivery system, and you have more to lose. And so there was an element, and still is an element, of trust that gets built into packaging.
Tom Hine is my guest. He writes about architecture and urban design for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's the author of the new book, The Total Package, and it's a history of packaging of consumer items. Do you think that packaging is heading in any new directions now?
Well, I think that it is interesting that there's getting to be less of it. And in fact, some packaging even says less packaging. That's a novel claim.
For environmental reasons.
For environmental reasons.
Cut down on the trash.
To cut down on the trash and cut down on the expense to companies that make the products. In general, of course, packaging is also following the society toward, away from the great mass brands that we're nostalgic about, like Heinz ketchup and Campbell soup, toward a variety of packages that appeal to narrower tastes.
You predict that it's possible that there'll be even less packaging in the future because we'll be ordering from catalogs and computers, and a lot of things will just be delivered to your home. So they won't be sold on the basis of an attractive package.
Well, I quote somebody saying that. There's been a lot of study of that, because real estate is a very expensive part of the whole merchandising system. And there was one of the big six accounting firms, did a study in Chicago which showed that it would be cheaper for a particular supermarket chain to deliver everybody's groceries than it would be for them to maintain supermarkets. But I also talked to some interesting marketing consultants who said that they thought that would make packaging not less but different.
Mm-hmm.
That when people choose the package in their home, either on TV or computer discs, the package will look more like their home. It won't have to jump so much out in the supermarket, but it will have to fit into their own lives even more securely.
Well, Tom Hine, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Tom Hine is the author of the new book, The Total Package. He writes a syndicated column on architecture and design for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Colonel Fred Peck testified before a Senate committee against gays in the military, even though he learned several days before his testimony that his son Scott is gay. Coming up, we talk with Colonel Fred Peck and his son Scott. The colonel's testimony thrust Scott into the media limelight. Now Scott has a new memoir called All American Boy. Colonel Fred Peck and Scott Peck coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities in Oklahoma City report 19 people have died in the bomb blast at the federal building. 17 are believed to be children. The building housed a daycare as well as several offices. At least 200 people are hurt. James Maravich is the vice president of St. Anthony's Hospital, which has treated many of the injured.
First wave that came in were mostly people that were on the street and had been injured from flying glass, and they had multiple lacerations. The more severely hurt patients came in second, and that wave there were someone with a broken arm, a woman in convulsions, someone had their carotid artery torn by glass.
Oklahoma City police have broadcast an all-points bulletin for three men traveling in a brown pickup truck with tinted windows. The blast is having a ripple effect on federal building security nationwide. Bomb threats have prompted evacuations at federal buildings in cities from Wilmington, Delaware, Cincinnati, Portland, Fort Worth to Boston. Security has been increased at several sites around Washington, D.C. Sergeant Dan Nichols of the Capitol Hill Police Department told CNN, after any event of this kind, security precautions are always taken around the Capitol.
Any incident anywhere in the nation or any international incident involves the United States government that may impact on the Capitol complex or the United States Congress will heighten our security, and we will respond to that as the situation warrants. I can assure you that the Capitol complex will be safe. We are taking precautions at this point. We are allowing the members of the public in, though, and the buildings will remain open to the general public as always.
Sergeant Dan Nichols of the Capitol Hill Police Department on CNN. The White House now says that President Clinton will deliver a statement on the bombing at about 5 p.m. Eastern Time. France has given the United Nations a 48-hour ultimatum to improve security for peacekeeping forces in Bosnia or face the pullout of French troops. The threat follows the killing of two French soldiers in Bosnia, Lynn Terry reports.
Prime Minister Edouard Balladur said in an interview on French radio that if the United Nations does not act in time, the French forces in Bosnia could be withdrawn. France has the largest contingent there, about 4,500 troops. Balladur said that the worsening conditions in the former Yugoslavia is compromising the peacekeeping mission. He said the French troops would only stay if they can carry out their mandate and if the ceasefire, which expires at the end of the month, is extended. In a separate radio interview, Foreign Minister Alain Juppé criticized both the United States and Russia for their handling of the Bosnian crisis. He said the Russians are encouraging Belgrade to ask for too much, while the United States is failing to put pressure on the Bosnian government. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 28 points to end the day at 4,207, but declining issues led advances by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. It's quiet on the streets of the Bolivian capital, La Paz. The government has declared a state of emergency and arrested dozens of labor leaders, hoping to end weeks of violent protests by strikers. Teachers and other government workers' strikes have been characterized as an attempt by unions to keep their power. The government is overhauling Bolivia's schools and economy. Strikers have clashed nearly every day with police. The government ordered the three-month emergency after talks, brokered by the Catholic Church, broke down last night. The Ford Motor Company earned $1.5 billion in the first quarter of this year. Company officials say they are optimistic that sales will continue to improve despite signs the economy is slowing. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Ford's earnings amount to $1.44 a share compared to the 83 cents a share the nation's second-largest automaker reported in the same period a year ago. That comes despite some slowdown in industry sales for the period in North America during the first 3 months of the year. And Ford officials say they still expect car and truck sales for all of 1995 to top last year's levels. In fact, company Vice President David McCammon today predicted that the industry will enjoy another 3 or 4 good years before it hits another serious sales downturn. General Motors is expected to release its first quarter financial report tomorrow. Last week, Chrysler reported earnings of $592 million for the period, a decline from the previous year. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Again, our top stories. Authorities in Oklahoma City report 19 people are dead in the bomb blast at the federal building in downtown Oklahoma City. 17 are children. At least 200 people have been hurt. 40 workers are still missing in the rubble. 200 people are injured. Secret Service agents who were in the building have not been accounted for. The president has directed Attorney General Janet Reno to lead an investigation. She has dispatched an FBI team to the scene. The president is to make a statement at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 2 years ago, Colonel Fred Peck stunned the Senate Armed Services Committee during his testimony against gays serving in the military. The colonel, who had just returned from a 5-month tour as Marine spokesman in Somalia, said, "If my son were to walk into a recruiter's office, it would be a recruiter's dream come true. He's 6'1", blue-eyed, blonde hair, great student. But if he were to consider joining the military, I would have to, number one, personally counsel against it, and number two, actively fight against it because my son is homosexual." Actually, the colonel had no idea his son Scott was gay until just a few days before the testimony, when Scott revealed his secret to the family. Scott and his father had not had the closest of relationships. Scott's parents divorced when he was 6, and he didn't have contact with his father again for 9 years when Scott's mother got sick and then died. Scott Peck has written about his relationship with his father in a new memoir called All American Boy. We invited Fred and Scott Peck to join us. I asked Scott what it was like, after having been in the closet for much of his life, to see his father testify that Scott was gay.
I guess I grew up always waiting for the apocalypse, and I thought it was about to happen.
What shape did you think it was going to take?
Well, my father and I had just put in, I guess, 3 or 4 years of really working hard to form some kind of relationship, because we had been such strangers to each other before that. And I just thought that that all the media attention, that his knowing that I was gay was going to just blow that all to hell. And I think that was at the forefront of my mind during all of that.
Did it?
No, it didn't. I think it made it better. And my impression is that it's just getting better and better over time.
Fred Peck, do you still oppose gays in the military?
I do, but I don't think that's really the most important thing in our relationship. Like Scott's saying, we worked hard over a number of years to get a relationship going, and to me, his sexual orientation when I learned about it was certainly not enough to derail my feelings of affection for him and where I thought we were finally going with our relationship, which had been estranged spiritually and geographically for so many years. So, you know, the fact that we happen to come together over an issue over which we disagree is kind of ironic, but if fathers and sons agreed on everything, you'd really have a scoop for NPR, I don't think it's that big a deal.
Fred Peck, do you oppose your son being gay, or do you just oppose gays serving in the military?
I certainly don't oppose my son being gay. I don't think he has any choice about it. It's like, do I oppose him being blonde or something? I think that it's part of him, and it's a part of his life. He didn't choose it, elect it, or anything else. So it's not mine to accept or reject, as far as I'm concerned. Scott is my son, and he happens to be gay.
Scott, what made you tell your father that you were gay? Did it have to do with with your knowing that he was going to testify on the gay ban?
Sure. I thought that I was going to be outed one way or another. I had been feuding with a group called Queer Nation in Baltimore, and I got the strong impression from them. I felt I was getting very clear signals, although they later denied it, that I would be outed when he testified. And I just had this nightmare image of him stepping out of the courtroom and being surrounded by reporters saying, "Well, do you know that your own son is gay?" Not that reporters would ever act that way. But I thought that the pressure that would put on our relationship would certainly tear it apart. And I didn't want that to happen.
So what reaction were you expecting when you told your father?
That's a simple question, but I guess I haven't. No one's asked me that in a long time. I think I was really expecting everything to come crashing down. I had always gotten the impression from my father that he thought homosexuals should be lined up and shot. And now I guess that that was a lot of bluff and bluster, or maybe his opinions have changed over the years. I don't know.
Well, let's ask. Fred Peck, did you used to think that?
I don't think I ever had that extreme of a view at all. I certainly never had any need in my own life to come to a conscious decision about relationships with gays and lesbians, because I didn't know any who were openly gay or lesbian as I was growing up or through my professional life. But I later in life, in jobs I've had since, such as I was in charge of the office in Los Angeles dealing with the entertainment industry, and I came in contact with a lot of people in the gay and lesbian community. So I don't have a negative stereotype of gay people per se. I've had to come to grips with it in a much more personal way, obviously. I had the same kind of reaction that what would my father think about it, who's now 76-year-old World War II-era Marine, and was extremely pleasantly surprised that he was very supportive and immediately wanted to call Scott and tell him that he loved him and he was going to stand by him, too, through this. So we've all been pleasantly surprised by our fathers.
So, Fred Peck, what was your reaction when your son told you that he was gay just a few days before you were going to testify in support of the ban on gays in the military?
Well, my wife is the one who broke the news to me. I got back from Somalia, and the next morning she told me I had to call back here to Washington because my presence had been requested at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearings, and I needed to talk to the Commandant of the Marine Corps' office. And she said, well, before you talk to him, I need to talk to you. And she just kind of said, well, there's no way to break this to you softly or whatever, and, you know, here it is, and came right at me with it. And the immediate reaction was one of shock and surprise, because Scott was the kid I knew who played football and went out with beautiful women and seemed to be the normal all-American boy, and I didn't have any inkling that he was gay. And I think, in hindsight, it was really good for me that the pressure was on, that I had to come. I didn't have a lot of time to anguish over it or think about it. I basically had to come to some quick resolution on my own about how I was going to deal with it, which was, hey, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference to me in terms of my son. It doesn't make any difference to me in terms of my professional career that I've chosen, and it's just not going to make any difference to me in terms of what I say to the Senate Armed Services Committee. It was an advantage being under the pressure to having to come to a quick decision about what to do with it.
Scott, did you consider asking your father to rethink testifying in support of the ban?
No, absolutely not. That I think in my heart of hearts, I was kind of hoping that that he would have changed his mind or that he would have chosen not to testify. But it didn't occur to me to ask him not to testify. That just didn't seem to be appropriate at all.
My guests are Scott Peck, author of the new memoir, All American Boy, and his father, Colonel Fred Peck. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Scott Peck, author of the new memoir, All American Boy, and his father, Colonel Fred Peck. The colonel testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee against gays in the military, even though his son Scott is gay. Colonel Peck, in your testimony, you said, I've spent 27 years of my life in the military, and I know what it would be like for my son if he went in, and it would be hell. I would be very fearful that his life would be in jeopardy from his own troops.
What led you to that conclusion, that it would be really dangerous for a gay man who was openly gay to serve?
Well, combat is a very terrifying experience, and in times of terror, men and women sometimes do things that are incredibly heroic. You also see people react exactly the opposite direction with terror and with acts of cowardice, with acts of violence against innocents, atrocities that are committed. I merely pointed out the fact that I would be very fearful that people would think, well, if we got rid of that person who I mistrust because of his sexual orientation, my life would be safer, and there would be a greater assurance that I might come home alive from the battlefield. For anyone who has been in or around it, the military and inner near combat, that is a very defensible statement. I'm not proud of making it. I didn't say it meaning to convey that I thought that was a good thing at all. I think it's terrible.
Scott, what do you think of your father's point of view on gays in the military?
Well, I don't think that that society is ready at all for unqualified individuals coming into the military, or for individuals entering the military to be activists or spokespeople or to do anything that's going to break down the cohesion of the unit. Usually when I'm asked the question, you know, do you support gays in the military, I say, well, which gays? Because it depends completely on the individual. Over the past two years, 15 individuals in particular and more have been serving openly while their court cases are pending. In most of those cases, they've gotten along just fine. I think it's really easy to hate gays in the abstract. I know there was a time in my life when I certainly did, when I certainly did believe that all gays should be lined up and shut, even when I suspected that I might be one of them. But when I think that if a Marine finds out that his comrade, whom he has been in battle with or who he has trained with, who he has trusted his life to and vice versa, has been gay all along, it's a very different experience. And in many cases, there seems to be an almost instantaneous reversal of thinking. Of course, if I'm wrong, maybe my dad has been too good at selling the Marine Corps to me, because I really can't imagine Marines blowing each other away over a difference of opinion. But if I'm wrong, I think that every gay and lesbian service member who comes out of the closet and serves will know that that is a risk that they are taking, and it's a risk that they're willing to take. And if enough gay and lesbian people die under those circumstances, maybe people will figure out who the bad guys really are.
Colonel, were there ever times in the military when you knew a man was gay and you had a... And he was not out, and you had a deal with whether to turn him in or not.
No, I've had a couple of circumstances where, going back to when I was a lieutenant, one of the men in my platoon when I was in the infantry, he came back after a night of drinking, and he sexually assaulted, it would be the terms you'd use today, one of his fellow Marines from our platoon, and not in a violent way at all. He wasn't a violent kind of a person. He thought he was responding to signals that his advances by his drunken friend would be favorably received, and friend did not react favorably, and so... The young man was then determined to be, by the psychological examination was followed, to be a homosexual, and he was to be processed for administrative separation from the Marine Corps. And I literally had to protect him from the members of the platoon. It was like, you know, they'd caught a peeping Tom in the barracks.
My guests are Scott Peck, author of the new memoir, All American Boy, and his father, Colonel Fred Peck. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what do you have coming up on All Things Considered about the explosion in Oklahoma City at the Federal Building? Terry, we are working on the story, trying to gather just as much information as we can, and of course the story keeps changing, so we will have the very best up-to-date information we can lay our hands on by the time we go on the air this afternoon. We have sent a reporter from our station in Norman, Oklahoma, up to Oklahoma City. John Burnett has flown in from Texas, and we are trying to stay on top of what all the public officials are saying about it, to see if, and talking to experts about the behavior of explosions, to see, to do the very best we can to stay up with the story.
Thanks, Linda. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guests are Scott Peck and his father, Colonel Fred Peck. The colonel testified against gays in the military, even though his son Scott is gay. Scott has written a new memoir called All American Boy. Scott, I think anybody who writes a memoir says things about friends and family that the friends and family probably won't want to read. And one of the things you write about in your memoir is about how your father was in the Naval Academy when he and your mother started seeing each other, and she got pregnant, and I think it was against the rules to marry. I think it probably was against the rules to engage in relations, actually. So your parents weren't married until you were 2 years old, and then they divorced when you were six. Am I misstating things to say that, that there was something less than following it by the book when when your father was in the Naval Academy?
I don't think so. Maybe my father could answer that more appropriately. My impression has been that at the Naval Academy you weren't supposed to be in a room alone with a woman, much less have fathered a child, although that's a rule that I'm very glad that he broke.
The rules are that you cannot be married or ever have been married to be a cadet or a midshipman in any of the service academies. Paternity or maternity now that women are allowed is also grounds for discharge. However, when you return from leave during the summer, Christmas time, they make you sign a statement saying, I have not gotten married while I was on leave or vacation. They never ask you to sign a statement saying, I have not had sired any children while I was on leave or vacation. I lived for better the part of 2 years with it hanging over my head that if Scott's existence became known, I'd be kicked out of the academy, probably given a little Dixie cup white hat and sent out to the fleet to serve for a few years as a sailor, which to me was probably a fate worse than death. I'd rather have been executed. At that point, I was so gung-ho about going into the Marine Corps. It put a tremendous amount of pressure on Michelle and our relationship, and it was one that became known to her parents, who then tried to make an issue of it with the academy, but for whatever reasons, I had friends in the hierarchy at the academy who chose not to pursue it. And so I went along, but I had this sort of Damocles hanging over me for the better part of 2 years.
I by all means don't want to be trite or cute, or I don't know what the appropriate word would be, in drawing a parallel between what my dad went through and the situation of gays in the military, although I was trained to be a minister, so I have an almost pathological tendency to draw parallels between everything and draw little sermonettes out of everything.
It is a good parallel. I agree with it.
Mm-hmm. We'll make the parallel for us.
The rule was in place, and my father broke it or bent it, and other people helped him to bend it or covered for him, and I think that it's a very good thing that happened, because it's a stupid rule, and it would have been, I think, a loss for the Marine Corps if my father had been booted out, or worse yet, booted into the Navy for just being himself, for being a human being. I think that would have had that would have been a very serious, very serious loss. And I, once again, without trying to be cute about it, I think one of the worst things about the current existing policy, as my father's example showed, I think very well, is that it's only the screw-ups that become known. It's when someone screws up, when a gay man hits on a straight man or does something inappropriate, that they are suddenly known. When someone tries to come out in an appropriate way, they are also kicked out. But the policy is sort of, it defends itself, it keeps itself going. Whereas if it were lifted and gay people and straight people were held by the same exact rules, And, well, if even gay people were held to a higher set of standards, I would have no problem with that. I think we could easily live up to that and diffuse a lot of the potential tension that way, if given the chance.
Colonel Peck, I'm wondering if you think it's at all hypocritical to have broken certain rules when you were in the Naval Academy and to now not feel comfortable about challenging rules.
But there are a couple of differences. First of all, everybody breaks rules there. It's kind of the game. In the lexicon there, I mean, you rate what you can get away with is what they teach you. In other words, like the Spartan ethic, hiding the fox under your cloak as it eats your intestines out, if you don't get caught, and you've, even though you violated the laws, you haven't really violated the laws. Maybe that's a warped point of view. It probably is a warped center of view, point of view. But the issue is, had I been caught, I readily accepted why they had the rule, and I can understand why they don't want midshipmen to be married at the Naval Academy or to have children while they're in the Naval Academy. If you establish that rule, it would severely jeopardize, I think, the training there, because you have to understand that when you change a rule like that, you don't take it for somebody who's able to manage it and without difficulty. You change the rule for everybody, those who can handle it and those who can't, and you have a bell curve of performance and people in whatever regard. The same would go for homosexuality. I mean, I knew that if I was caught, I was going to get kicked out, and I wouldn't have argued about it. I said, "You got me, I'm gone."
Colonel Peck, you're used to dealing with the press. You're a spokesman. You're a spokesperson for the Marine Corps. Is this a completely different kind of experience for you, dealing with the press, with your son, talking about family matters, as well as gays in the military?
It's oh so easy to talk about other people's problems and foibles and mistakes and very, very difficult to talk in personal terms. I've been an extremely private person. Scott tells people that I smoke, which I don't. Not since 1987 have I smoked a cigarette. You know, those kinds of things. There are people who've known me for 20 years who didn't know that I smoked. Just those little things. Now, then we get on to the biggies. Oh, a third wife, child born out of wedlock while you were in the Naval Academy, no contact with your son for years and years and years. What kind of a person are you? Not the flattering picture of me, and I think I come across, you know, in Scott's perception as being self-centered at times, arrogant at times.
Wonderfully human is the way that...
Wonderfully human and a totally lovable person at other times. But the book has a happy ending, and we're a work in progress, and it has been good for us. As I was saying, it's been cathartic for us as a father and son, and dealing with it publicly has not been easy, but... it's maybe even good in that it forced us to come to grips with things that we wouldn't have had to do otherwise.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Peck's new memoir is called All American Boy. Special thanks today to Laura Carlson at station KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.